court is ready to hear argument in 040460, the State of Texas and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department versus Ricky Schumacher and others.
May it please the court, Ms. Danica Miller, the defendant argument. The Texas Tort Claims Act and the Recreational Use Statute strictly define the class of cases for which a governmental entity may be liable and thus sued. The Shoemake's premises liability claims fall outside the scope of the Tort Claims Act waiver because they are barred as a matter of law and definition by the Recreational Use Statute. And contrary to the Court of Appeals conclusion, they may not rephrase their premises liability claims as claims for gross negligence. Therefore, the court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision and dismiss this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The proper resolution of this case depends upon two very basic principles. The first is the common law trespasser standard, and the second is this court's holding in Keach versus Kroger. For over 100 years, we have understood the common law trespasser standard not to give the landowner any duty with respect to the premises. That means he owes no duty to seek out dangers on his property, correct dangers that he is aware of, or make warning regarding dangers that he is aware of with respect to trespassers. The only duty a landowner has as to trespassers on his property is as to his conduct, not to engage in gross negligence or intentional misconduct.
But would you agree that the recreational use statute contemplates that the landowner knows that there will be people entering onto his property?
Of course. The legislature intended that that would be the effect of the recreational use statute.
So wouldn't it then be consistent that the standard should be in some form of a known trespasser?
No, Your Honor. We do not believe that to be the case at all. If the legislature had intended the known trespasser standard to apply, it would have said so. And it could have done exactly what the Court of Appeals did. In the discussions in the legislature leading up to the enactment of the recreational use statute and in subsequent amendments, the legislature debated whether to require landowners to warn of dangerous conditions about which the landowner knew and the user of the property did not. Had the legislature chosen that standard, that would have been the licensee standard. But that standard didn't pass the legislature.
I'm curious what you think the common law is apart from this. As I understand it, if I want to work on the sprinkler system in my backyard and they don't finish it in the day and there's a big old hole out there, I don't have any responsibility to mark off that hole or try to keep people from falling into it. That's your understanding.
That's correct.
conveniently, however, I know that kids run back and forth in my backyard and sometimes at night. And it wouldn't hurt my feelings if they fell in that hole and quit doing that. Now, I'm not really hoping for that, but I'm just saying it wouldn't hurt my feelings. Still no liability there?
No, Your Honor. Under that circumstance, the attractive nuisance doctrine would control this court.
No, they don't know it's there. You think it's in my yard is an attractive nuisance.
I would say that it's possible anyway. Yes, if you know that children come and run around your yard and you know they're going to be there and you've dug a hole in your backyard, then that's a possible cause of action under the attractive nuisance doctrine. As to an adult trespasser, though, Your Honor, absolutely not. If a trespasser comes upon your property, you are not required to prepare for that trespasser to come, take any reasonable precautions, or post any warning signs in anticipation that that trespasser will come.
Even though I'm relatively sure he's probably going to come.
That is absolutely true. The restatement.
What if I really do? I want him to stop coming, and I hadn't been able to get him to stop, so I dig a hole, hoping he'll. I put it in his path.
Well, that of course will be a man trap or a pitfall, and that would be intentional misconduct on your part, and the common law trespasser standard does make room for that liability. Intentional injury caused by traps set by the landowner will support liability for the trespasser against the landowner. Because we have no duty for the trespasser to take care with respect to his premises.
Is there a carve out for grossly negligent conduct?
There is a carve-out for I wouldn't call it a carve-out, though. Let me re-answer that question.
What is contemporaneous grossly negligent conduct? What is that?
Contemporaneous negligent gross conduct would be active gross negligence, which the court stated as long ago in 1943 in Texas Gas Cities Company versus Dickens, that the trespasser is only entitled to protection from active gross negligence and has no right to recover for passive gross negligence.
Because let me ask about a different. Let's slightly change Justice Heck's example. Let's suppose you know children play in your backyard. There's a big old hole back there. Kids know it's there. You know it's there. You know that when it rains heavily. That hole fills up with water. The children don't. The child comes through your yard as they normally do and drowns in the hole. Are you liable?
I think that again would fall into the category of tractable.
But how is this different when you put a culvert out there and you know that when the rain gets to a certain level or the river gets to a certain level that it's going to be a problem. How is that any different?
Well, I think in this case, the attractive nuisance doctrine doesn't apply because the attractive nuisance doctrine doesn't apply to the governmental unit.
Why?
Because the Texas Tort Claims Act says so.
If it says you treat them just like a private person for trespassers, why is their duty different than a private person's to a trespasser?
We have to back up, and we have to look at the recreational use statute in relation to the Texas Tort Claims Act. The recreational use statute, expressly does reserve the attractive nuisance doctrine with respect to private landowners. But the Tort Claims Act does not contemplate that sort of negligence against a governmental entity. So a private landowner may be responsible for an attractive nuisance with respect to children. In this case, of course, we are talking about the Shoemakes coming into a governmental property to a property where they had no right to assume that the premises would be safe for their enjoyment. That is exactly what the legislature intended to do when it enacted the statute. The legislature balanced the benefits of more property being available to the public with the potential harsh consequences of a wide class of cases for which there would be no recovery. The legislature knew when it was enacting that the trespasser standard, that there was no duty to assure the safety of the premises for the landowner at common law.
Well, the facts as I understand it is that there was a culvert installed here. There was knowledge of fast-flowing water when the water was above the culvert. There was knowledge of near drownings or other potential injuries. Why isn't that gross negligent conduct?
Because that would be gross negligent conduct for failure to warn or failure to make safe. That is the duty owed to a licensee. The landowner does not owe a duty with respect to his premises, and if he owes no duty with respect to his premises, it cannot be negligence for him to fail to take action with respect to his premises. It can also not be gross negligence for him to fail to take action.
Where's the attractive nuisance carved out?
I'm going to have to look that up for you, Your Honor, while I'm on the break, but it is in the Texas Tort Claims Act, and the Court of Appeals did address that section in the opinion below.
But if the city has a park, and there's a nice little stream that runs through it, and they build a bridge over the stream, and they say, well, how sturdy should we build this bridge? And they say, well, let's make sure it holds 50 or 80 pounds. And knowing full well that lots of adults are going to walk over that bridge, and every once in a while somebody's going to fall and hurt themselves, probably severely. I doubt that patrons of the park are suspicious that the bridges that are constructed for their use are not going to hold them up when they walk across them. But in your view, they have no cause of action against the city.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct.
What's the policy rationale for
the policy that? Rationale is that the legislature wanted more land to be made available to the public. And I would hasten to
add... But not so we could cripple them, so they could have fun.
Exactly. And there's no reason to think that governmental landowners or private landowners out there are out there intentionally designing defects on their premises. It's quite the opposite. In the hundreds of thousands of or at least thousands of property that is on the Blanco State Park, for example, we only know of approximately two or three incidents involving this stretch of
the river. What does the record show as to why there was no warning when there were previous mishaps at this very location?
Well, of course, the record is in dispute on that, Your Honor, but the information we pretty much can all agree on is there had been significant rain in the season immediately preceding the Shoemakes' visit to the river, and the river was at flood stage. It was up high. There were warnings posted by the department that said, swim at your own risk, no lifeguard is on duty. The department had in the past experimented with putting flags up to demarcate where this culvert area was, but the flags kept getting swept downstream, so that didn't work. They had ordered signs, the signs that actually expressly said, beware of swimming in this area, but those signs had not been able to be erected prior to the Shoemakes accident. All of this, though, is extra duty. The department didn't have a duty to warn with respect to the premises, even though it took some action. It had signs posted as well at the area where people checked in to pay and in the bathrooms about swift water currents. The department went above and beyond the call of duty in trying to warn patrons, even though it had no duty to do that. And we can't turn its failure to warn about those defects into gross negligence, because that imposes the licensee standard.
Counsel, you agree, I take it, that Tort Claims Act carves out a limited waiver for, among other things, premises defects and injuries arising out of conditions or use of property. Is it your position that the recreational use statute, however, bars all premises defects claims?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, with respect.
What language in Section 75.002 provides such a bar? It certainly in B2 says that the duty for a person grant permission or to whom an invitation is extended is no greater than that owed to a trespasser.
That is correct.
Where does it say the premises defects are expressly barred?
Premises defect claims are barred to a trespasser. And so we would urge the court to find that, although, of course, you will not find language in the recreational use statute that says what I'm arguing, that premises defect claims are barred, that's the effect. That was the known effect for what the legislature did when it adopted the trespasser standard.
So you can't conceive of a situation where there could be a premises defect leading to injury that was caused by initially grossly negligent conduct?
I'm certain that that could happen, but under the court's opinion in Keach versus Kroger, that cannot support a cause of action for grossly negligent conduct. If an injury arises as a result of the premises, it is strictly a premises liability case. And premises liability cases are barred under the recreational use statute by virtue of the fact that the legislature consciously chose the trespasser standard.
But if the act were malicious, it wouldn't matter if it happened in the past. If you maliciously constructed a defect on the property hoping that people would be hurt, do you think there is liability or not?
I think if a private landowner maliciously constructed a trap hoping that patrons would fall in, absolutely, that would fall into the intentional misconduct.
And that would be true under the recreational use statute?
It would be for the private landowner, yes. As if we insert a state entity in that equation, though, Your Honor, no. That would be an intentional act for which the department would not be liable under Section 101.057, I believe, of the Texas Tort Claims Act. And to the extent the court might conclude that that act was grossly negligently done, it would simply be beyond the scope of the tort concept.
So the state could intentionally dig a hole to intend to injure someone in a recreational use context and still have immunity?
Well, the legislature has expressly stated that the
yes
state will not be liable for the intentional. The individual absolutely would be liable.
The state?
No, sir. The state would not be liable for the intentional misconduct. The state, absent the recreational use statute, forget that, is never liable for the intentional acts, the intentional torts of its employees. The legislature has made that clear. That's certainly not in dispute today.
Let me ask you this and see how far we go with this. Blanco State Park has a swimming area, which recreational use, and nearby are these high-tension electrical wires. And one night there's a storm. One of the wires falls into the swimming area, and the state knows it. And that state knows if somebody gets into that water, they're going to be electrocuted and killed. No liability.
No liability, Your Honor. We can sit here all day and posit horrible fact scenarios, and there will be countless. In the hundreds of thousands of acres of public land that there are across the state, there are undoubtedly dangers that we know about and dangers that we don't know about. And the legislature knew all of that when it considered how many causes of action would not get compensation if it adopted the trespasser standard under the recreational use statute. The words trespasser, or invitee, and licensee have meaning that the legislature is charged with knowledge of when it adopted the statute. It rejected a standard which would be similar to the licensee standard, duty to warn of a known danger about which the department knows, but the visitors to the property do not. To impose liability on the department in your scenario, Justice Green, would be the licensee standard. We can't do that in this case because the trespasser standard applies.
But you could if it was a known trespasser.
Under the known trespasser standard, as the Court of Appeals found, yes, if that's the standard that applies, then, of course, liability would attach.
You cite several times in your brief for the proposition that the state owed no duty in these circumstances to Miranda, but you cite to the dissent. What in the majority opinion in Miranda supports your position that there's no duty?
Certainly. In the majority opinion in Miranda, the court reached the conclusion that there was no active negligence, or at least there was not enough pleading and allegation of active negligence to support a cause of action under the Act. And the court,
we didn't use the term active negligence in Miranda.
You did not. But those were the allegations that the Mirandas had, of course, in addition to several premises liability claims. Now, the department did not argue in that case. It was not presented to the court. The court did not have briefing or argument on the position that we are taking here today, and that is premises liability claims are not actionable. But in Miranda, the court dismissed the Mirandas' claims because there was no active gross negligence, although, be it, the court didn't.
Well, in Miranda, wasn't the issue about whether the plaintiffs had pled gross negligence, and if they had, then whether there was a fact issue raised as to whether gross negligence should be determined by the finder of fact in order to determine immunity. What was the issue in Miranda about active versus passive or some other type of gross negligence?
Of course, the court was not asked to pass upon active versus passive. That is my characterization of the Miranda's claims. The court was not asked to pass upon whether active versus passive was required. The court was not asked to pass upon whether premises liability claims existed. The plurality of the court determined that the gross negligence allegations were sufficient to bring the cause of action under the recreational use statute and the Tort Claims Act, but that there was not sufficient evidence to survive the department's plea to the jurisdiction. We would submit that Miranda is really the precursor to this case. This case presents the question, assuming the Shoemakes have made allegations of gross negligence, do those allegations of gross negligence arise to the type of conduct that is actionable? Not that pleads a cause of action or will survive a plea to the jurisdiction based on pleading, but does it affirmatively bring the cause of action under the Tort Claims Act, or does it lack jurisdiction on its face?
Thank you. Counsel, are there any further questions? The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
The court. Mr. Les Mendelson and Mr. Ricky Poole will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Les Mendelson will open with the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Les Mendelson from Fair County Court, Your Honors. In this case, we will show the following in regard to the opinion by the court below. We are applying a statute here, and in applying the statute, the court should strictly construe the terms of the statute initially in order to determine what the purpose of the statute was and to give effect to that purpose. Gross negligence has never, by this court, required any contemporary conduct. We will explain to you how and why that has become engrafted by some courts of appeals. Please note that the state does not challenge in its brief that we established by our pleadings and by our summary judgment evidence that the two elements of gross negligence were in fact established at the trial court level. That is, that the pleadings were sufficient, and secondly, that there was evidence of gross negligence that at least created a fact question.
Your brief seems in two parts, and maybe I've misunderstood. I want to be clear about this. In the first section, you argue this is premises liability. There's a premises defect. It doesn't matter where it was, whether it was artificial or not. In the second part of your brief, you say, well, let's at least adopt the restatement where they create an artificial condition. Is that correct?
Yes, but as we will show, there really is no difference if you're going to apply gross negligence as to whether the gross negligence standard is applied to a naked trespasser as opposed to the known trespasser. And I will explain to you how that's true. The standard of liability will be discussed by Mr. Poole, that there was never an intent by the legislature to eliminate a premises defect case. And under the state's theory, of course, there can never be a gross negligence case based on a premise defect. Now, the statutory cause of action...
My question is, does your position include existing just the premises itself, regardless of whether it's artificially created or not?
Under the facts of this case...
I'm talking about your position on the statutory construction. Does it matter?
Yes. As it applies to the facts in this case, as to the statute, if you're going to apply the so-called known trespasser...
Let's suppose you have a trail, a mountainous trail. It's not maintained by the state, but the state knows that people hike on it, and that after a rain, it's partially crumbled and becomes dangerous. And they know that.
You go back to the standard. If in fact that creates an extreme risk of harm, that is, that it's likely to cause injury and or death, that they know those facts, that it's likely to cause injury or death, and they do nothing other than just let things go as
they were.
What
do you do about rattlesnakes?
Rattlesnakes are not what we're talking about.
Well, they're on your premises. You know there are rattlesnake dens out there. You know that people hike. You know that people have been bitten several times. It's an extreme risk of harm, and you do nothing.
That is not this case, Your Honor. This case deals with an artificial...
I'm trying to test the limits.
Okay.
Is it artificial or what are the limits?
Definitely it's artificial. It may be a case to be decided another day if they do not actively create the harm. They're not actively creating the harm when they allow the rattlesnakes, which are part of nature, to be there.
What about the trail that's eroded?
They created the trail?
They did not create the trail, but they know people have followed a trail and created
that. That perhaps is not actionable, but that's not this case. We're talking about where the state creates an artificial, dangerous condition that it knows is likely to cause death or serious injury to a patron. That's this case, and based on that concept, there should be liability.
So in other words... If we set aside Big Bend Park where we have no roads into it, therefore we know everybody will be safe. Of course, nobody can get into it.
Okay.
What's the point of having parks that no one can get into?
Well, that is, again, respectfully, Your Honor, that is not
the case. I know that. You say that's not your case. I know you want a rule that just says culverts, they're liable for, and nothing else they are. But we can't write that rule. We're trying to say, what with the statute we have, why is it apply only to your case and not everybody else's? You say, well, because it's artificially created. But if a park is to be used, there will have to be roads. There will have to be signs. There will have to be bathrooms and all this other stuff, and each one of those, once the government does that, then they become liable.
No, potentially liable. Well, they don't become liable unless they know, in fact, of a risk or a peril that is likely to cause injury or death. But they know that, and they don't do anything. That's what this court held in the Andrade case. It said that ordinary negligence rises to the level of gross negligence when the defendant or landowner knows of a risk of harm that is likely to cause injury or death and does nothing. That's your law in 1999. So all that we're saying is that what the court below did was say that when there is an edifice, a structure, something that is done by the state that it knows, not should know, but knows, will cause or has caused injury or death, it then has a duty to remedy that situation.
Well, there's
one way or another.
There's on 360, there are these cliffs that rock climbers are constantly going out there and climbing on. And let's suppose three or four of them a year fall off and have serious injuries. What's the state's...
They don't create that danger, Your Honor. They don't. It's not an artificially... created situation.
So you are limiting your argument to artificially...
Well, they didn't tell your client to go swimming either.
They invited her to go swimming because the family had a pass. The park was open for swimming. There was nothing that prevented them from swimming.
So they could avoid this problem by preventing all swimming.
They could avoid.
And have only parks where you can't go swimming.
No, sir. When they know that there is a, this is a very important distinction. When they know that there is a risk, using the Morial standard, which was again adopted or reaffirmed in the introduction, if they and in the Miranda case, it was cited. If they know that there is an extreme risk of harm, and they have subjective knowledge of the effect of doing nothing and they do nothing, then that is a standard for gross negligence. All we're saying is that it's a gross negligence standard. We're not saying you have to warn, you have to keep out. It is a very high standard. But we have met that standard with our pleadings and with our summary judgment proof, to which the state has not made any claim in its brief that it's not adequate.
Do you think your standard would apply to security concerns in parks that are in urban areas? They build all these walkways and places for people to stroll through the trees, but at night somebody can lurk out there and do violence.
That would normally be an ordinary negligence situation. It could possibly rise to a higher level if you can show that they have created a man-made structure of some kind that they know itself is dangerous. That's completely different. You're talking about human conduct. You're talking about engaging in activities. We're talking about a situation where the state affirmatively does something. The state has this wonderful idea that in order to get rid of javelinas that might come on into the park, it's going to put a mountain lion out there, and they're going to get rid of the javelinas. And they know that the mountain lion has already sucked up at least a couple of people. Yeah, you might be able to prove in that situation. Our position is not that we have established it. We're saying that there is at least a fact question. And the important point is that, if I can move on, that there is no requirement by this court in any case, certainly not in Miranda, and not in the cases that are relied upon, to show that there must be contemporaneous conduct. If you look at the cases that are relied upon by those courts of appeals, which are engaging truly in judicial legislation by engrafting onto this statute something that was never intended by the language of the statute or by anything that has been brought before this court. The whole concept of contemporaneous conduct is a throwback to the Keach case. The Keach case is different. We're not talking about the Keach case. Keach, there was a need for there to be an activity. There was a need for there to be contemporaneous conduct because of the fact that conduct had to be a cause of the harm. It had to actively cause the harm. That's not what the requirements are in this instance. In this instance,
was it a culvert that was placed on the premises that caused the harm, or was it the deluge of rain?
Several things. There are several flooding. And I would tell the court that although we did not present this as an activity case, if the court feels that it should be an activity case, then we would ask that the case be remanded because the facts that are shown by us in our summary judgment proof are that there was the reason why the water was flowing so rapidly was not just a natural phenomenon. It was because the powers that be for the department determined, and this is in the record, they decided to release waters. And they also inadequately marked off the property. And they also inadequately protected the public from the vegetation that grew there. And there were no grates. It was a combination of things. And the court could take the position, if you go to that extreme that the state wants, that there has to be an activity. The activity was allowing the water to flow so rapidly through this area.
So you're
saying that activity was ongoing at the time that the child was drowned.
So, counsel, you're saying, if that's the conclusion of the court, that we should remand the case to give you an opportunity to amend?
Yes, Your Honor.
How many times did you amend at the trial court?
After the plea was filed. It was, I beg your pardon?
How many times did you amend at the trial court after the plea was filed?
I think there were three amendments after, or two, I'm not certain. But there's no question that there were amendments. However, we posited the case as a premises case.
Mr. Mendelson, your 12 minutes has expired, and continue as you wish.
Please, the court. My name is Ricky Poole, and I also represent the Shoemake family. Justice Owen, I want to briefly supplement part of the answer that Les Mendelson gave to your question regarding the briefing on this case. The initial issue that we briefed in the case was to directly address the question of, is this only a negligent activity case, or is there also still a premise defect claim? The position by the Parks Department is that from this point forward, or perhaps even before, there is no premises defect.
I understand. I'm just trying to get your position.
Yes. Well, our position is there is a premise defect claim.
And based on artificial or not?
Artificial. Because we adopt the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals, we believe, got it right because the Court of Appeals struck a balance.
But comment B to the restatement notes, we don't see any reason why this should be limited to an artificial condition. Nor do we see a reason why it should be limited to a risk of harm less than death or serious bodily injury.
The court is not required to adopt in total the restatement.
But you're arguing to us now as if we were a common law, making a common law decision here. We are dealing with a statute and legislative intent. And do we think the legislature intended to adopt this section of restatement or not? Comment B or not? We're not making this decision in a vacuum.
I understand that, Your Honor. We believe that the legislature intended to adopt a trespasser standard. However, that standard has to be read in context of the situation that was being addressed. The legislature was looking at persons that it knew would be coming onto the property. Now, opposing counsel has argued to the court that there's 100 years of trespasser law that this court should adopt in this case. The problem with that is that this statute wasn't around for 100 years. In fact, that case law applies to a very different set of circumstances, and those circumstances should be considered by the court.
I'm sorry. I'm confused. I really am. We throw around the premise defect and all these monikers, but my understanding of what your co-counsel just argued was really premises defect doesn't matter. If someone's grossly negligent, it doesn't necessarily have to be contemporaneous conduct, but gross negligence is enough. That those old common law constructs of trespasser would work in this situation, irrespective of premises liability. So I'm confused as to why we keep focusing on whether there's a premises claim left. We have an amicus brief from the Texas Municipal League, and they say that the common law trespasser definition that existed at the time the statute was enacted was that a landowner's only duty to trespassers is to refrain from injuring them willfully or maliciously. Now, I understand you to be arguing that's what you're claiming here. And so I'm a little bit confused as to why we're delving into the premises defect aspects of this.
Well, our argument in this case is that with a premise defect claim, you can have gross negligence. As this court recognized, or we believe, recognized in Miranda, allegations of gross negligence do not require that it be a negligent activity case.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying, but nor do they require that it be a premises case either.
That's true, but this is.
But I just thought I heard your co-counsel say that you weren't complaining about a failure to warn, that it was active gross negligence in not rectifying a known dangerous situation.
Well, I believe what my co-counsel stated was that we could survive under either theory. We could either be under a negligent activity theory, in which case this court, we would ask this case be remanded back to the trial court so that could be more adequately pled, because that was not an issue that was raised in the plea to the jurisdiction to the trial court. The state did not make that argument in the trial court. In this case, though, as pled, we have pled it as a premises defect case. So that's why that makes a difference. You can be grossly negligent in failing to warn of a dangerous condition of which you know, assuming that that dangerous condition creates an extremely high degree of risk. Now, in this case, there's no question that the dangerous condition does meet that standard. We have evidence, testimony in the record that three people nearly drowned at this same location. The issue that was raised earlier by one of the questions by this court was whether or not this is then going to mean that we're going to close down the parks. And I know that's an issue that has been raised to some degree by the amicus briefs that have been filed. That has absolutely no bearing on what this court decides today if this court adopts the holding of the Court of Appeals.
With regard to the Court of Appeals opinion, the supplemental opinion, do you agree that our opinion in Miranda overruled Lubbock versus Rule and the contemporaneous gross negligence rule?
You know, I don't think the court addressed it in that way.
Which court?
This court. I don't think this court expressly overruled Rule in Miranda. But I think to the extent that Rule holds that you can only have a negligent activity theory under the recreational use statute, this is the case where the court can say that's incorrect. And I think that would be consistent with the court's holding in Miranda. There was no question in Miranda that there could be a claim made for gross negligence under a premises defect theory. Now, going back to closing the parks, the fact that you have a road in a park does not, because you have a road, mean that there can be a claim raised under the recreational use statute. However, if that road, for whatever reason, creates a condition that may kill or severely injure a person, there should be a duty on the part of the owner of that road, to the extent the owner knows that that condition exists, there should be a duty that that information be transmitted. And the failure,
which in your case is, three people say, I almost got hurt in the same way.
Yes, sir.
And after that, whatever it is that you've built is grossly negligent.
Well, if three people say that I nearly drowned or I nearly died because of
that, or I nearly got run over because it was a blind corner, or
if the
curve was too sharp or anything else.
Right. And Your Honor, you know, we can have those fact scenarios on both sides. We can have the horrible fact scenarios and we can have those that are not so horrible. But ultimately, it comes back to how are you going to craft the remedy? And we argue in this case that the remedy should be crafted in such a way that if there is knowledge of that artificially created condition, if that knowledge exists, and the knowledge is that it's going to cause death or serious injury, there should be responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Justice Owen, to answer your question, Section 101.059 of the Tort Claims Act states that this chapter does not apply to claims based on the theory of attractive negligence. Attractive nuisance. Accordingly, the Tort Claims Act does not provide a waiver of immunity for those claims. So independent of the recreational use statute, causes of action arising under attractive nuisance theory are not actionable against the state. I think it's very telling that Mr. Poole described the Court of Appeals opinion as striking a balance. That is exactly what it was. The Court of Appeals was clearly troubled with the fact that the facts of this case are very sympathetic. And it is a harsh result to tell the Shoemakes and others like them that they have no recovery against the department for the injuries that they sustained. There's no disputing that fact. But it was not the Court of Appeals' place to strike a balance. It was the Court of Appeals' place to apply the statute. And the statute, as written, adopts the common law trespasser standard. It makes no mention of the known trespasser standard. In fact, it applies these facts to a situation where the legislature knew the trespassers.
Yeah, I mean, you'd agree that's sort of an odd application and a bit obtuse if that's what the legislature intended. I mean, they are crafting this with a title that says recreational use, with the premise of open up your land so people can use it, whereas the common law formulation doesn't anticipate people divorcing.
Exactly, and they are artificially ratcheting down the duty that landowners owe. The legislature took an entire class of cases where, common law, there would be liability because these visitors to the property would have at least been entitled to licensee status, if not invitee. And the legislature artificially imposed the trespasser standard. And in the debates and in the bill analysis, the argument was about whether or not we should impose upon the duty that is requested by the shoemakes, warrant of unreasonably dangerous conditions about which the landowner knows. That's the common law licensee standard. And that's not the standard that the legislature imposed. And the proponents of the bill in the bill analysis state that the users of the property should assume the risk of the dangers in the property. The legislature knew that it was imposing a very harsh strata or structure. And it did it nonetheless to ensure that more property would be open to the public. It is not correct to say that the legislature was not aware that gross negligence in respect to a trespasser, not gross negligence in other contexts. You can certainly have failure to warn and gross negligence by omission in other contexts, such as the Andrade opinion that Mr. Mendelson referenced. But that's not how gross negligence is applicable in the trespasser standard. Again, dating back to this court's opinion in Dickens from 1943, trespasser may only recover for active negligence. He has no right to be free from passive negligence. And as respects to artificial conditions on the property, the common law recognized that landowners would have artificial conditions on their property and nonetheless did not require them to fix them, repair them, inspect them for dangers in anticipation of trespassers. The court's decision in Galveston Oil Company versus Morton expressly contemplates dangerous machines or contrivances on the land. And unless they are illegal, the landowner owes no duty to do anything with those contrivances in anticipation of a trespasser. He only has the duty not to inflict injury caused by grossly negligent conduct or intentional misconduct. This court should not engage in the balancing act that the Court of Appeals engaged in and that the shoemakes would like the court to engage in. Because as all the hypotheticals that we have posited here today would demonstrate, the exact situation that the legislature was trying to control for and eliminate, that is, dangerous conditions that arise every day on property.
Counsel, do you see a difference between degree of care and duty owed?
I don't think so. I think those are two sides of the same coin. We speak in terms of the duty of care being the duty to act as a reasonable person, the duty of care being the level of duty that we require a landowner to act with respect to trespassers and licensees. I think they are the same.
Statute speaks of degree of care. Do you think that means duty as well?
That's how I would interpret the statement, Your Honor, yes. To get back to my point, the court should not be troubled, if it can help it, by the harsh consequences of this case. This is what the legislature intended. The legislature knew what it was doing when it enacted the statute.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will take a brief recess.